The Science Basement!
Hello and welcome to the Science Basement Podcast, a podcast for those who love all things science. I'm your host Anastasia.
And I'm your co-host Eleana.
Around the same time last year, we did an episode to mark Mitochondrial Disease Awareness Week, which is a global event with the mission to raise awareness of rare mitochondrial diseases. The dates slightly vary, but the event typically spans the last week of September, with this year's dates falling between 18th and 24th of September. Coincidentally, Eliana and I hosted the previous episode together, and I'm happy that she is back supporting me on this little project once again.
And I am more than happy to be making another episode dedicated to mitochondrial diseases, and I am looking forward to learning more on the subject.
I mean, you already know quite a bit just by talking to me and also from the previous episodes. I guess they'll be part of the refreshment of your memory, plus, probably lots of new information for sure.
I'm sure there's a lot of new information from our guest today, Rohit, who is a medical doctor. And if that didn't take a ton of his time, a large chunk of it will be dedicated into PhD studies that Rohit is doing on the side. And for his PhD, he is also focusing on the mitochondrial research. It is through his doctoral work that he met many mitochondrial disease patients and gained substantial experience diagnosing and managing their condition. Hello, Rohit, and welcome to our podcast.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for having me.
So a quick disclaimer is that Rohit and I are actually from the same lab. And although we study different mitochondrial diseases, so Rohit focuses on Meira's disorder, and I study mainly mitochondrial myopathy. We will talk about these diseases in a moment as well.
Yeah, I'm happy that you will say a few more things about it, because now you dropped a lot of words that are not familiar to me, and I bet also to many of our listeners who are not from that field of research. But without further ado, maybe we can start by breaking down things. And of course, with the most straightforward question we could ask. So, Rohit, what are mitochondria and what do they do?
So in just plain simplicity, mitochondria play an essential role in generating metabolic energy. And all cells require energy to function.
Just generally the powerhouse of the cell. I mean, I know it's not very good to overuse this phrase, but I mean, every time I say it, it just clicks with people. So I use this as my guilty escape way when I also introduce mitochondria. And just to add to what Rohit said, yes, mitochondria are incredibly important for the energy. They are considered the energy batteries of the cell. But at the same time, especially over the recent years, we've been exploring a lot on mitochondria, and a lot of other functions started adding up to what it actually does in the cell. So it also helps in metabolism of calcium or even cell death in certain conditions. So it's really indispensable part of our cell.
So understandably, if something doesn't work well with them, we are kinda, well,
screwed up.
Oh, you said it, Anastasia. I was avoiding to say that word, but yeah, we are kind of screwed up. So
yes, we are screwed up because even like evolutionarily, without mitochondria, the life as it is and the organisms that we turned out to be now wouldn't have been possible. Because originally mitochondria was just a floating bacteria somewhere like in the soup of civilization at that time. And one of the big cells just ate it, and it decided instead of digesting it and breaking it down into smaller pieces, it just kept it. And they found themselves in this very nice little collaboration that one cell was giving something to the other. And so this is how mitochondria became the part of the cell. There's also an important point coming from that, and that will be also important later on for when we discuss mitochondrial diseases. It's because mitochondria used to be a bacteria. It had its own genome. is usually in the shape of a ring. And over time, a lot of that genome migrated into the genome of its host, which in our cells is encapsulated into a nucleus. It's packaged in the nucleus. And now mitochondrial DNA has only 13 proteins, so it's very, very small. And a lot of other genes that make like a big structure is mitochondria. It's encoded in the nuclear DNA. And that is very important for later.
That is very interesting. I didn't know about it. And it get me thinking while you were explaining it, Anastasia, because we had briefly discussed that in the first mitochondrial dedicated episode we did, but I didn't remember all these details. So what comes to my mind is that it's a codependent situation. It started between two organisms that realized they can benefit by living with each other. And the one was absorbed essentially inside the other. But then not only we depend on mitochondria for the energy they provide us, but if I understood right, it kind of depends on the cell that they live in, because if part of the genome they need is in the main nucleus, then could mitochondria live without the cell?
No, they cannot exit anymore. And you, at this point, you cannot even consider this as a separate organism. It is indeed just a part of a cell. Well, not just, but it is a part of the cell.
So in evolutionary line, two independent organisms made a pact and they became one eventually. Cool. So we talked about like what mitochondria are, how this whole situation of having them within our cells started, and how important they are for us for generating energy. So the next question to be asking is probably, how are we impacted by them not performing as they should and having, let's say, what are called mitochondrial diseases?
Right. So, I mean, if we just sort of take a step back and we think about what sort of cells are most predominant with mitochondria? Well, we've got the brain, the heart, skeletal muscle, or just muscles in general, the gut, and obviously scattered throughout in all our cells, except red blood cells. So any sort of dysfunction in mitochondrial activity would lead to problems with, for example, neurological symptom, or the cardiovascular system, or in gut function, or even skeletal symptoms.
Yes, and it's usually considered that the tissues that require a lot of energy will suffer the most from the lack of that energy. And as Rohit said, indeed, like in the most cases, muscles and brain, I would say, are the typically main affected organs. Of course, there are other ones involved too, but if we look at the range of different diseases and like the main organs that are being involved, those two will be the most common ones. Just also to add a few numbers, mitochondrial diseases are considered as rare types of diseases, although indeed, yes, they are. They're not as typical, for example, as cancer or Parkinson's disease. At the same time, we also need to take into account the scale of human population. I checked very quickly one of the recent publications, and there they put very nice numbers for the scale. So they're saying that rare diseases affect less than 1 in 2,000 people. But with over 7,000 different diseases, together they present a major healthcare challenge affecting over 300 million people worldwide. And mitochondrial disorders will affect 1 in 4,300 people.
That's a big number, yeah. And you mentioned something about the affecting the muscles. And in our body, we have a couple of muscles that do a lot of work, especially in supporting us living. So when people think of muscles, they think of the muscles that keeps us moving. But what about the lungs that helps us breathe, or the heart that helps us pump blood and therefore oxygen throughout the body? So I suspect there are some mitochondrial diseases that affect lungs and heart and therefore impede people's existence not just in terms of mobility, but also in terms of that, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, the symptoms would be very, very heterogeneous, obviously, depending on what kind of mitochondrial disease is under discussion. Once any organ or a group of organs stop functioning, then, as you said, it would cause massive hindrance for the patient.
Actually, heart is also a muscle.
Exactly, yeah.
When I say muscle, that's, of course, also including the heart. And kidneys and all those, they all will suffer in some way. It's just for some reason, there would be this one mutation that affects mainly one organ, but not somehow other ones. And that is one of the main mysteries of mitochondrial research that labs all over the world try to figure out. Like, why are certain mutations so specific to this particular set of symptoms? To be honest, like, we have some clues, but we don't really have clear answers. I guess we can also just give examples of mitochondrial diseases. And I can start, for example, just outlining very quickly a few to show how many other organs they can affect. For example, there is a very common one called Lone disease. It stands for Leber Hereditary Optic Neuropathy, and it affects eyes, so basically eye vision. Then there's progressive external ophthalmoplegia, which is one of the mitochondrial myopathy diseases that I study. And it affects the muscle, eye muscle movements and drooping eyelids. So patients have big troubles even just moving their eyes and looking around. And in some more complicated cases, it can go down to all the rest of the body muscles. There is Leigh syndrome, which affects central neural system. And one of the examples is MIRAS, which Rohit studies. And he is the perfect person to talk about this one.
So MIRAS stands for mitochondrial recessive ataxia syndrome. And as we're in Finland, it's most commonly recessively inherited ataxia syndrome in our country, in the Finnish population. This disease is enriched in Scandinavia and occurs in all populations of European origin. Without going to the gene mutations and all that, it's the mutations in the DNA polymerase gamma that encodes a mitochondrial DNA replicase and hence causes disease.
And if I'm not mistaken, here in Finland, the gene pool is very small. It's not as mixed as in Southern or Central and Eastern Europe, which means that probably the higher numbers that are present of MIRAS disease here in Finland is maybe linked to how narrow the gene pool is and how circulated this mitochondria would be, right?
Exactly. Currently, our data suggests that the carriership for the MIRAS mutation is in a ratio of 1 to 84. And till now, we've diagnosed up to 80 patients. And concerning this ratio that I just mentioned, clearly shows that the disease is well underdiagnosed.
Maybe you already mentioned and it slipped my mind, but what are the most common symptoms people have because of MIRAS?
So just to bottle it down to some of the predominant symptoms, we're talking about epilepsy, we're talking about polyneuropathy, ataxia, dysarthria, cognitive and psychiatric symptoms. And the most interesting fact in regards to this disease is that all our patients are carrying the identical genetic mutation for MIRAS. However, the sort of phenotype or the symptoms that they're presenting, it's of such a wide range. Considering we've got such a homogeneous patient group leading to such a heterogeneous sort of phenotype, it makes this disease really remarkable. We'll have patients who have disease onset with epilepsy in their teens. We might have patients in their mid-20s, 30s, who present a disease with ataxia and polyneuropathy. And then we might even have patients late in their 50s who present a disease only then. And we, as of now, we still can't explain why this happens.
And actually, that also adds to how difficult it is to diagnose it in the end, because it cannot be that, according to a textbook, this disease has like this set of symptoms and it occurs exactly around this age and blah, blah, blah. So here you really need to have some sort of knowledge beforehand that, okay, this disease can start at different ages and has different types of symptoms also depending on that. It's really extremely difficult in this way, especially when you're dealing with other diseases that have similar symptoms, and then you just have to wonder, okay, do I do this test now, or do I do that test now, or do I give them this treatment or some other treatment? Yeah.
And I have a naive question, because as I understand, this is such an underdocumented cluster of diseases, the mitochondrial diseases in general. So is it possible that there hasn't been yet a found pattern of the symptoms and the onset and any kind of relation because of the low numbers of people who have been diagnosed, so that maybe there have been a lot of people who had some symptoms when they were younger, but they were never diagnosed. And then they got one of the symptoms just suddenly appear later down the line. And people say now, oh, yes, that's an indication of a mitochondrial disease. Or maybe they stumbled upon a doctor who was more familiar and therefore properly diagnosed them to begin with, because many times you might go to a doctor who is not specialized in some rare diseases. And as this was classified as a rare disease, it wouldn't be something all doctors would know. So is it possible that this absence of homogeneity in the symptoms and the time in the life of a patient that they appear could be due to exactly that, not being either diagnosed or diagnosed properly on time?
So, I mean, as you said about patterns, this is a sort of disease that doesn't have any kind of patterns. I mean, we obviously have an overall view of how the symptoms do present and the variance between patients. And the way it works is that a patient might show one symptom and have that certain symptom progress over time, and then over time present new symptoms, and there's no specific order. Currently, we have no idea why certain symptom kicks in and another symptom doesn't. And that's the issue. If a patient comes to a rural general practitioner's visitation with ataxia or polyneuropathy, well, then they'll obviously start investigating common reasons behind this. And for example, alcoholism or lack in vitamin B, and trying to correct these, eventually it leads nowhere except just the symptoms just getting worse over time. As the symptoms just progress and progress, more new symptoms come about. That's when the bell should start ringing that there's something else. And obviously, with more expertise and more knowledge over time, I believe doctors are more aware of neurological diseases and mitochondrial diseases specifically.
And I guess also it comes to practice, because of course they probably teach you, right, in your med school, all these diseases and that they exist, like the all the other types also of rare diseases, not only mitochondrial ones. Well, when you work in a clinic, at least from my other medical friends, I know that you usually encounter the same types of diseases, and majority of your work is just treating the same types of disorders, same types of infections. It really requires sharpness of your mind and acute awareness that there are these other extraordinary cases, and it needs, in a way, this agility to adapt to these changing situations and adjust your diagnosis based on this. Hopefully also raising awareness with events like this will ring the bell in their minds, or maybe just give a small refreshment that maybe one of the patients should be tested for these.
Yeah, as a non-doctor, thinking about diagnosing something, like, because you mentioned some of the symptoms and they are not very rare or unique, because I think somewhere there, Rohit, you mentioned like vitamin deficiency of a certain vitamin. And then if someone goes to the doctor with a vitamin deficiency, the first thing that would happen will be to prescribe supplements. And then if the supplements fix the problem, they won't dive into what's the root of the problem, because vitamin deficiency could be from lack of having a good diet, and that could trigger the disease. But as you said, it's not automatically linked to the disease. And if a doctor, as you, Anastasia, said, doesn't know about it, then they wouldn't put two and two together. And I suspect that quite often patients go reporting, at least at the beginning, symptoms that are not that unique or rare from other diseases as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, in the past 4 or 5 years, ever since I joined the research group, I think I've met around 24 of patients, and I've heard each and every one's story on how their disease trajectory came about and their first few contacts to their doctors. And it always starts off with one of these symptoms that I mentioned. Obviously, the patients are worried. Some of these patients are young, working age, and realize that, you know, something's wrong. And then when they go to their doctor, they may not necessarily get the help that they need. You might get prescribed something, or you're sent to tests, and they lead to something completely inconclusive. The patient's still worrying what's going on. They don't have a name or understanding of what's happening. And then they'll keep on going back to the same doctor, another doctor, and then all this just takes time. And eventually, we always want to think the best interest of the patient. And it's just really unfortunate to hear from our patients that they've been sort of bouncing around for years and years until somebody decides, or somebody suspects, a mitochondrial disease and has a blood test taken and get a diagnosis.
Yeah, and that obviously also put a toll on them. And it could be possible that some gave up, say, I don't want to go from doctor to doctor anymore. Nobody can find what I have. And if it's not that severe that will impede with their everyday life, I suspect that some people have just gave up on trying to find what they have, and probably they remain undiagnosed, which would be pity.
I completely agree. I would say that in Finland, the threshold to go to a doctor's varies. So there might be patients out there, even, you know, as we speak, who may have a mitochondrial disease.
Absolutely.
Mildly symptomatic, and they might not ever go to a doctor's. And this obviously leads to, you know, cases of undiagnosis. Then there might be a time when the symptoms aggregate, and only then would get a name for the disease.
I would say that's a tricky thing with also other types of diseases. Even when I have some kind of infection, I don't necessarily go to the doctor straight away. I will wait until it's completely maybe unbearable or it's been too long, and then consult with them. It's not necessarily a problem in Finland where there's free healthcare. But I know, I think that in the United States, people sometimes prefer not to have diagnosis of these types of diseases or maybe chronic conditions.
Yeah, I think in Finland, we have the privilege of having free healthcare. And of course, there are lack of doctors, if I'm not mistaken, here in Finland, that might affect how well or how quickly you might get a proper diagnosis. But yeah, in other countries, the situation is way more complicated, and that's very unfortunate.
Yes, this will affect decisions of insurance companies for their support. And this is an unfortunate reality we live in. Of course, one thing is to have a diagnosis, but the other thing would be to actually have some kind of solution to resolve the issue and to find some kind of treatment of the disease. And apart from figuring out the symptomatics, this is one challenge of mitochondrial diseases. And the other one is, of course, the ways of treatment. And here, for every disease, there'll be a separate approach. I must say that so far we can talk mostly about symptomatic treatments and not so much about the cures. Those are the tricky ones to address at the moment. But Rahil, what about the treatments, at least for MIRIS disease? How do you usually approach that?
So as you said, for MIRAS and other mitochondrial diseases, the cure is obviously what we're aiming for. But we unfortunately don't have any sort of medical interventions to cure disease. The only thing that we can sort of provide our patients is any shape and form of symptomatic relief. We'll have patients with depression, which we can treat with medication. Some of our patients have epilepsy, so they can be prescribed anti-epileptics. In MIRAS patients specifically, we've seen in several cases that it's not one medication, it's not two medications, but they might even need three medications just to sort of seize off the epilepsy. Yeah, so they'll have this sort of polytherapy for combating against epilepsy. Now, these are just sort of symptomatic reliefs, like tablet-wise, but what our patients really, really seek for is physiotherapy, for example, because like I said earlier on, nobody can ever predict this progression of ataxia, for example. Young patients, people in their mid-20s, 30s, it might not even be very long when they start to lose their independence in terms of walking down the street on their own. And especially in Finland, considering the winter times when it's slippery, very snowy, challenges in just walking around. So when patients who start losing their independence in terms of just walking, physiotherapy is what they would really want. And that's something that they need.
And of course, depression can come from the disease itself and amplified by these difficulties of the everyday life. But for epilepsy treatment, I think there were some issues regarding those ones, if you can remind.
Yeah, in epileptic MIRAS, we've seen that these patients display extreme sensitivity to valproic acid, which is a rather common anticonvulsant. In these patients, it can lead to subacute fulminant liver failure, potentially requiring a liver transplantation as a life-saving measurement. Reason behind this, why this specific anti-epileptic causes liver failure, still remains unknown. And hence, with awareness of MIRAS in Finland, more and more patients coming in their teens with epileptic seizures, for example, doctors know to avoid valproic acid.
Would they avoid valproic acid already in general, or do they first decide to diagnose and check and then they will give valproic acid?
Well, the thing is, nobody would ever want to take risks with Polgia patients. So we've just established this sort of general rule. If a patient has a Polgia mutation, valproic acid is contraindicated. And this is something that's also put into their patient profiles as a risk information. So if somebody was to prescribe some valproic acid, then the patient system would inform the doctor that it's contraindicated.
Do they diagnose all patients with epilepsy for this type of mutation?
No. What we've seen is that our teenage patients predominantly manifest their first symptom with epilepsy. And for example, patients in their mid-20s or 30s, even in their 50s, who've manifested with disease with something completely different, ataxia or polyneuropathy, for some reason, some of them may even present with epilepsy later on in life. And we just have no idea why.
Just reminds how difficult a doctor's job is. I cannot imagine.
It is difficult, and it's a kind of a job I suspect you need to be educated throughout your whole life nonstop because of all the new research and new numbers coming in. So are there any efforts currently here in Finland, but also abroad, if you know, has there been any effort for educating doctors nonstop on mitochondrial diseases and their symptoms? And I suspect that could help improving diagnostics.
Yeah, there will be clinicians who will probably never, ever see a MIRAS patient in their entire career. And then there may be some doctors who may see more and more of these. But I think expertise, it just comes with time and the ability to suspect more rare sort of a disease that also comes with time and experience. But the fact that medicine has evolved our diagnostic methods past 10 years, it's progressed so intensely. With just a simple blood test, we can easily diagnose a mitochondrial disease. So I think just a small awareness or just a suspicion could be enough to give the patient a name for their symptoms. And I believe that's what they've just wanted.
Genetic testing, of course, is one of the major ways of diagnosis of mitochondrial diseases. There are, of course, other tests like biochemical tests. There are some markers for that, but nothing really beats the genetic testing. I think with the developing technology, it's become more accessible to people as well. It's not as complicated as it used to be.
Yeah, because it wasn't only complicated, it was also very expensive. Well, because it was complicated, of course, but it was not accessible to many people because your public healthcare couldn't afford genetically testing everybody for this kind of diseases.
Expensive, I mean, it still probably is quite pricey. And I would say here is that depending on where you're from, it may be considered expensive or cheap.
That's good to highlight it, because on that, I would also highlight then why it is important as governments of different countries to invest more money into making genetic testing more accessible, because there are many genetic diseases that might have fallen under the radar and they are just too expensive to test every baby. So unless the parents have already been diagnosed, that's what I'm trying to get to, unless the parents have been already diagnosed, for you to learn that you have a genetic disease means something happens to you in your life and they have excluded everything else. And then you end up with that. And I know it from experience. And then they tell you, yeah, that's what it is. But to reach there, it's like the last step because of it being very expensive. So I think more money needs to be invested in maybe also research to make genetic tests faster, cheaper, more accessible, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely. Not very long ago, I mean, now we've been talking about just simple blood tests, which doesn't sound very invasive, but there was a time when, for example, liver biopsy was a thing.
Biopsy meaning that they take a piece of your organ, pretty much.
A little piece of your flesh.
Yes.
And it's an invasive procedure. So thinking more from the patient's aspect, this blood test is much well received.
It's pretty straightforward. We all have been through it.
Yes. But then should there be some kind of line of testing? So when you go to the doctor and you have some symptoms that could be one thing, but also could be something more rare, then especially with the numbers of people having been diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, shouldn't be part of the routine that when they take blood for different lab tests to see what you have, that one of the tests to be done would be searching for mitochondrial diseases?
That's actually a really tricky question. I've always said that common causes are most common causes for disease. So best to start off with just the common causes. And if diagnostics leads to inconclusive results, that's when the doctor should be able to suspect something else. And if an area is not in their field of knowledge, they should be able to refer it forward.
There's a lot of ethics involved. Like if you could sequence your genome for all the kinds of mutations and sort of know in advance what kind of diseases or predispositions you're going to have, would you do this? And sometimes it's really hard to say, should you actually be doing this or not? Because maybe you will find a mitochondrial disease and diagnose yourself early, but maybe you will find also all sorts of things that you shouldn't be concerning yourself so much with, because it will just make your life very difficult. So in a way, maybe it would be nice to have people diagnosed en masse and early. At the same time, that will be incredibly overwhelming for doctors. It may create a lot of panic and needless stress. So there needs to be some sort of balance figured out for these.
That reminds me of a movie called Gattaca back from the
1990s. It's great. Everybody should watch it.
Yeah.
It really, really nicely breaks down that message. Yeah.
But I understand what you mean. Like you don't need to know every genetic mutation you might have, because not all of them could kill you, I suspect, but some may. So shouldn't you know sooner than later? But what I'm trying to say is that probably some diseases that will impede a lot with your life, it is something you would like to be able to be diagnosed with as early as possible. So it's not about scanning your blood or your genome for everything, but for some things, why not?
But you don't know which mutation you're going to have. So you will have to scan for every known mitochondrial DNA mutation. Or maybe there can be some novel variants that haven't been reported yet. It's very complicated. I see the sentiments and your point of view as well. At some level, it will also boil down to individuals. Because I think if you can pay extra, Rohit can also correct me here, but can you just, like if you pay your own money, you can just scan yourself for these types of mutations. So you don't necessarily have to wait. You can just go yourself, but it's up to you really if you want to do this in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Whether it's MIRAS or any other disease, getting a diagnosis as soon as possible is always what we're aiming for, right? And if possible, start with treatments. But I guess now I'm just going to talk with my experience with Miras patients. What they've established is that having like one doctor who's seeing them from start to end really helps them out. So somebody who takes their worries properly, carefully, investigates thoroughly, and goes through a sort of systematic differential diagnosis like pathway, just eliminating other causes and just going from there. But I guess just the fact that they've got a doctor who holds their hand and carries them thus far until they get a diagnosis, I think that's the most important thing, so that nobody gets left out.
And also, if you have a mutation, for example, that runs in your family, so if you are at least aware that something like this is there, then you can also use this for your future generation. And here I will make a not a very slight transition into the rather new development in mitochondrial medicine, because I mentioned that we don't have currently any cure of mitochondrial diseases. So here, again, I will correct myself a little bit because, well, there are some developments towards finding the cure, although they need more optimization. One of these methods is called being a mitochondrial donor, which is when they take a fertilized egg of a person who has a mutation in mitochondrial DNA, and then they take an egg of a donor, some other woman who has healthy mitochondria, and then they transfer the nuclei. Well, they're called pronuclei because it already has a nucleus of a dad and a mom. So they transfer those into a different egg, which has a nucleus removed. And so basically that egg will then have a genome of a mother who wants to have a child, will have genome of a father, and then it will have genome of mitochondria of a third person who is a donor. This is a unique case where a person can have three parents and not just two. And this is also going back to what I said earlier, why you need to remember that mitochondria has two genomes. Well, there are two genomes that have a mitochondrial DNA because one is encoded in the nucleus and one is in mitochondria. So this method is rather limited to mutations that are specifically in the mitochondrial DNA. So if you have a mutation in your nuclear DNA, that will be a little bit tricky. There are, of course, other also ways you can address this, but with this methodology, you can only resolve so far the ones that happen in mitochondrial DNA.
Good that you pointed that out, because I was just going to ask, but what happens with the DNA that is relevant to mitochondria and it's already in the nucleus of the cell?
Yeah, and actually, until very recently, it hasn't been recognized as an actual treatment. So I'm happy to say that in the UK from 2015, it is legal, and in Australia 2021, that is even more recent. And Eliana, you're Greek, so you'll be proud to know that in Greece they have clinical trials now for this method.
I'm happy to hear about that. I know in Greece we kind of love jumping onto these things and getting treatments. It's a joke, but we love going to the doctors, and there's plenty of them in Greece to go to, so we don't have that problem. But I was going to ask, because you mentioned earlier about the ethical complications, and now you mentioned this kind of procedure became only legal in the UK in 2015 and in Australia in 2021. In Greece, you said only now they're starting clinical trials. And I suspect the reason behind that would be this kind of ethical complications. So what can you tell us about that?
I wouldn't say I'm an expert completely, especially on the legal part of these methodologies. What I can say from what I read just online is, and of course, when it comes to human studies, it's extremely difficult to do any types of experiments. It needs to go through so many legal authorities to prove that it's safe, that it's feasible, that there is some kind of preliminary proof that it's going to work, and make sure that it's as safe for people as possible. So I would assume that's why it's so difficult to push these things through. In a way, also when it comes to some any kind of genetic modifications or modifying your genome in any way, because here we are still in a way modifying our mitochondrial genome. So that usually freaks people out. So we really need to make sure that there are no other complications to this method. And it starts slowly, so we will see also how it works long term, at least in the UK population, now in Australian population. And maybe things will change also in other countries. There'll be more recognition to that.
And since you guys have been talking about mitochondrial transplantation, we sort of even touched on the topic of MIRAS and liver failure in association with valproic acid. Some sort of mitochondrial transplantation has been done already, and we would call it liver transplantation. So our patients who've required a new liver have gotten one, and they've received years to live, perhaps even some sort of alleviation of symptoms. It's obviously very hard to measure. But all we know is that they have a new liver with mitochondria that are supposed to function normally.
That is a very good point. Yeah, I actually didn't even consider it this way, but it is indeed just transplanting also a different genome, right?
But it's very interesting to hear about the treatments, but I wanted to hear from you, Rohit, a little bit about your experience with the patients, because you see them a lot, you interact with them, and you probably hear from them about what are their daily life challenges.
Just to bottle it down, it's just losing your own independence. You know, eventually lose your ability to walk. Just holding a spoon, for example, while you're eating, all just becomes so difficult. Eventually, you might need help from other people, whether it's nurses, somebody coming all the way to your place to help you, or then your family members. And also, considering the fact that some of our patients are in their 20s, 30s, they're studying or working, all these can be dream-shattering. Whatever ambitions, plans they've had, it all has to be rethought.
Of course. So there's a lot of moral support these people will need as well.
And I guess also finding job. I mean, as you mentioned, they need to rethink their career path at this point. Even in general, just finding a place that will take you in might be a challenge by itself. Well, adding to that as well that it's a devastating thing for the whole family, not only for a patient alone. They will require a lot of support from their closed ones. And in the case when a person starts developing something later in their age, in a way it's a bit easier because they still know how to manage themselves. It's something that maybe will progress a little bit slower because if a mitochondrial disease starts later in age, they're usually a bit milder. But when it's very early, when the onset is very early, the diseases are usually very severe. They develop very rapidly. And in this case, you really need to think quickly how to act, how to manage your life, and just seeing the future in general. So these families are going through a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine. And one thing that comes in mind is whether there has been provision from the state, at least here in Finland, easing the workload and the daily life of these people. So obviously, many of them cannot work, or they cannot work enough hours, and they cannot be supported by their parents forever, because maybe at some point parents pass away, then what happened to you? So what kind of actions have been taken to ease their lives? Or have you heard, Rohit, from your patients that they would have liked more support on some domain?
Yeah, definitely. Most of my patients have explicitly said that they would have wanted more support at the time of diagnosis. But I think with doctors having more and more better understanding of this disease and how it behaves, now they've been able to project a few years ahead. So if somebody's if they're working currently and they require some adjustment at work, this can all be done with a doctor's recommendation, for example. So I feel like things are being taken seriously. And if the patient's situation changes, then it has to be accustomed for her.
As a researcher, I can also add that at least psychological support, as much as we can, hopefully will help them. At least to our abilities as scientists, I see it some conferences, we meet with patients, there's attempt to, in communicating our own science to them. So it's not just that we are doing everything in isolation. People do consider patients at all times, and they try their best to explain their work, even though it's not always very easy task to do, as we already know.
You need good SciComm skills, yeah.
To me, it's also admirable to see patients united by this common challenge of the chronic disease. They come together in organizations. They're specific mitochondrial disease organizations. They can raise funding for mitochondrial research or for families. They have regular events to promote these types of diseases. So for example, what we're doing also now, Mitochondrial Disease Awareness Week is done in collaboration of different mitochondrial organizations and scientists. So everybody's involved. And later the same week, so we will be releasing this on Monday when this starts, and that same weekend, there's going to be an annual event called Light Up for Mito, when many buildings all over the world will be lit up in green. This is to raise awareness of mitochondrial disorders. Unfortunately, after Corona, there weren't very many buildings lit up. So hopefully this year there'll be more of them.
Fingers crossed about that.
Yes, and if you happen to see any of these green buildings, just remember what it stands for. I don't know, post it or tell other people what you learned from this podcast episode. And that will mean already a lot to them, knowing that somebody knows about their struggles and what they're going through.
It's very nice that there are these kind of initiatives. It always shows how community support is important and necessary. Of course, it cannot be the only thing, because in this whole passage that you mentioned right now, Anastasia, you said about the psychological support these people need. And sometimes we as people living life along people with these kind of rare diseases, we can provide to some extent support, but for some cases you need specialists. And in many countries, they lack specialists with expertise in psychology and providing psychological support for these people. I wanted to take this out there, that it's something that people yet haven't acknowledged how essential psychological support is from professionals along society for some people to live a healthy, happy life.
And well, with that, I hope everyone listening either learned or got reminded of how complex mitochondrial disorders are. The good thing is that we're steadily getting closer to finding more suitable ways and effective treatments for these diseases. And with mitochondrial donors and the gene therapy that we mentioned, there are even prospects, of course, to curing them.
This is a very, very bright note to leave the episode, looking into the future and all the future treatments that may come our way for mitochondrial diseases. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Rohit, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Anastasia, because I felt like I asked a lot of questions and both of you gave the answers. So I was in a unique position in this episode, and it was a very interesting experience.
It was an interesting experience to me, too. I usually interview other people for science communication, and now I felt like doing actually the other side of it. Yeah, that was... Well, we'll see how it turns out. I hope people weren't lost in my lengthy explanations. And to everyone who stayed till the end, if you like this episode, please check out our previous one from 2022, where we talked to Professor Anu Vartiovaara. She is the supervisor of me and Rohit. She had a deep insight into the topic of mitochondrial diseases from her long-standing experience in this field. And also do check out our social media. You can find us on Instagram and on Twitter by the same name, The Science Basement Podcast. And really appreciate your feedback, which can help us to improve our content. Again, thank you very much for listening. Have a fantastic day and see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye. Bye. The Science Basement.
If you liked this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate it on the podcast app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in being involved or interviewed? Get in touch at the podcast@thesciencebasement.org.